United Nations experts continue their assessment of Europe's largest nuclear plant.
We have been seeing military activity around the plant, and I was able to see myself and my team impact holes.
Plus, the United States military releases a new assessment of Russian forces.
Recently, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed an order to increase the size of the Russian military to 1.5 million soldiers. In the U.S. perspective, the effort's unlikely to succeed.
And later in the program, the growing environmental concerns over an unexplained Russian gas flare close to the Arctic. Today is Friday, September 2nd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Experts from the International Atomic Energy Agency are continuing their assessment of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which is located in southern Ukraine. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi updated reporters shortly after returning to Vienna on Friday evening. Standing in front of a monitor, he was briefing reporters on their latest assessment of the plant as it pertains to their seven pillars of safety.
So first is the physical integrity of the facilities. What you see here is a red, and it's a big red. Why is it a big red? It's because there's still, we have been seeing military activity around the plant, and I was able to see myself and my team impact holes, markings on buildings of shelling. So which means that the physical integrity of the facility has been violated not once, but several times. And this is something irrespective of the kinetic power of whatever you are throwing at the plant is unacceptable in any way, under any safety and security criteria. When it comes to the second pillar refers to the safety and security system being fully functional. We assess it with a yellow because some of them, or most of them, are working and are working relatively well, but there have been interruptions, some of them related to the physical break in cables or in some connections, and still also in some systems that are not fully back in place. When it comes to the operating conditions for staff, this, as you know, has been one of the main points and continues to be one of the main points of concern, because this situation in Zaporizhzhia, we have this unique, unprecedented situation where you have a Ukrainian nuclear power plant, which is controlled by the Russian occupying forces, creating a situation whereby you have a cohabitation of the operators, people, the Ukrainian people, employees, and professional experts that have been working there, and there's also presence from Russian nuclear experts and also military forces. We don't put it fully red for one reason, and it is that the plant continues to operate and there is a professional modus vivendi, if I can put it like that. They work together, and the plant, as it is obvious, because it has been operating, two units as of today are still operating. The same code we are applying to off-site power supply. This has also been a matter of enormous concern and interest around the world, because, as you know, if you don't have off-site power supply, the cooling systems for the reactors cannot work. If they cannot work, this can lead to a major accident. We have seen on several occasions that there have been blackouts or interruptions, or one or two or three of the lines feeding the plant from outside. At the moment, There are two operational, and what we know also is that when there was one situation of a total complete blackout, the diesel generators operated normally.
And that's just a portion of the briefing. Grossi said that the IAEA would maintain a permanent presence at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant so they could accurately relay what's actually happening there. He also expects to present a full report on this initial visit sometime next week. VOAnews.com/Flashpoint will have the latest developments on the war 24 hours a day. This week, Human Rights Watch released a 71-page report entitled We Had No Choice, Filtration and the War Crime of Forcibly Transferring Ukrainian Civilians to Russia. VOA Ukrainian Service reporter Natalia Cherikova spoke with Rachel Denber, Human Rights Watch Deputy Director of Europe and Central Asia, about the organization's findings. Now, there was a slight problem with the recording, so you'll hear some clicking as well as a periodic echo.
How do you define being forcibly deported? Because in some cases, we know that people were just offered the buses, but they didn't have a choice where to go. They were only one way to Russia.
So I think this is a really important question, Natalia, because in order for the definition of the forced transfer, and a forced transfer is a war crime and a potential crime against humanity, in order for it to apply in a situation like in Ukraine, where it's an armed conflict, and one side is bringing people to the opposite side, or to other occupied areas, for the term forced transfer to be applicable, you don't have to actually put a gun to somebody's head, or you don't have to drag them in handcuffs. You know, what we documented was how Russian authorities, Russian forces, or forces that are affiliated with Russia, pretty much just made clear to Ukrainians whom they were offering evacuation on a bus that they had no other choice. And that's, in fact, the title of the report, We Had No Choice. Pretty much told them they had no other choice, that they had to take, you know, they had to get on this bus, that if they stayed, sometimes they said, well, if you stay, it'll be so much worse for you, you're not going to survive. Or sometimes they didn't say anything at all. In some cases, they didn't tell people where they were taking them off to. In other cases, they actually rounded people up from bomb shelters, from the streets, sometimes also on house-to-house searches, rounded people up and put them on these buses to so-called DNR, and then onward to the Russian border. That's a forced transfer because they're not giving these people a real choice.
What about the filtration camps and the separation of families? Because we know that families are trying to escape together. And then on the Russian side, the men are separated from their families and sent into the filtration camps where they can often be beaten and tortured and, kept there, as one of the people who you talked to said that he felt like a hostage.
Right. I think that almost everyone we talked to who went through filtration felt that they were a very coerced situation. Some people felt like they were hostages. Some people felt like they were, being accused of a crime. This is a very, obviously, a very abusive process. That had no legal framework whatsoever. If Russian authorities are entitled to set up a screening process for people who are voluntarily going to Russia, that's not what the case was here, first of all. And second of all, even if they're setting up a screening process for security reasons for people who are voluntarily going to Russia, there are certain boundaries that they and limits that they need to observe.
That's the Deputy Director of Europe and Central Asia at Human Rights Watch, Rachel Denber, speaking with my colleague in the VOA Ukrainian Service, Natalia Cherikova. Moscow denies committing war crimes and has also previously denied it's forcibly moving civilians from Ukraine. An assessment by U.S. defense chiefs and intelligence officials have concluded that Russia is replenishing its depleted forces in Ukraine with thousands of mercenaries from the Wagner Group and prisoners as Ukraine continues its offensive to recapture seized territories. Washington said Russian forces are beset by morale, logistics, and supply problems, which have bogged down their operations on several fronts as the war continues. International Edition's Chinedu Afor speaks with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden to learn more.
Russian forces took a bigger hit, according to Western assessments, than Russia was anticipating. And building those forces back up has been problematic. Just recently, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed an order to increase the size of the Russian military to 1.5 million soldiers. And the U.S. perspective, shared by a senior defense official just recently, is that the effort's unlikely to succeed because not only has Russia been having trouble of late, but historically, Russia's not been able to meet its personnel and strength targets. According to a senior U.S. defense official. And this specific target that they're talking about is one that would grow the Russian military by about 137,000 troops. The latest U.S. assessment also warns that Russia likely began its war against Ukraine back in February with about 150,000 soldiers short of what its targets were, and that of the force it did have, about a quarter of those troops were conscripts and maybe did not have the level of training or the experience needed for the type of operation Russia ultimately ran in terms of the invasion of Ukraine.
Analysts are somewhat surprised that the administration will release such a sensitive information about Russia's troop strength or lack thereof. Why do you think they did that?
The U.S., though, consistently going back to before the invasion began in February, has been coming out and sharing intelligence designed to undermine Russia's credibility, expose Russia's plans, and expose its weaknesses. And one of the concerns has been whether or not Ukraine, over time, would be able to stand up to the force the size that Russia had. And Russia had one of the larger militaries, one of the better equipped militaries, according to conventional thinking. And despite those advantages, and still having the advantage of air power that Ukraine does not have, Russia has not been able to assert that type of dominance in its war with Ukraine. And the U.S. and other Western countries have frequently been calling Russia out on these weaknesses, citing the morale problems, citing the problems with coordinating joint action, coordinating troops on the ground with their hybrid activities, with their air activity, and having it coordinated in a way that was going to pack the biggest punch against Ukraine. Those things have not happened in the way many Western military analysts and intelligence officials expected, and the West, including the U.S., has consistently been quick to call Russia out on that for a couple of reasons. First of all, it helps galvanize their views. It also gives more confidence to Ukraine, which the Ukrainian troops on the front lines, because it gives them some hope. It gives them, according to this view, the hope that they can not only compete with, but outlast and potentially even push back Russian forces. And according to the U.S. and other Western countries, you're already beginning to see some of that during Ukraine's southern counteroffensive, where some Russian units have been observed falling back as Ukrainian forces and battalions move forward.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent, and he was speaking with International Edition's Chinedu Afor. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Russian troops have used Belarus as a launch pad for missile strikes and air raids on Ukraine. In response, Western countries have imposed tough sanctions on it. Maxim Moskalkov has those details.
During the Russian war in Ukraine, Belarus has been acting as a de facto Russian ally. The landlocked country has been run by President Alexander Lukashenko since 1994 and has maintained close ties to Moscow. From its shared border with Ukraine, Belarus has allowed Russian troops to use its territory as a staging ground, and Russian missiles have been fired into Ukraine from Belarusian territory. In response, Western nations have imposed harsh sanctions against Belarus that have affected all sectors of the economy. President Lukashenko has defended Russia's invasion but has not committed troops to the fight.
Belarusian troops never crossed the Ukrainian border supporting Russia. And I think this never happened in part because inside Belarus, military establishments made it clear to Lukashenko that if it were to happen, it's quite likely a large proportion of Belarusian soldiers will change sides to support Ukraine. I think it was a strong deterrent for Lukashenko.
Belarus launched a harsh crackdown against peaceful anti-government protesters in August of 2020. with 1,300 political prisoners, demonstrations largely quieted. But when Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine this year, people again took to the streets, and opposition groups are actively working to help Ukrainians.
Guerrilla fighters are operating. They tried to slow down the advancement of Russian troops to the Ukrainian border. An information resource, Belaruskiy Khayun, posts in real time, informing its readers about Russian aircraft takeoffs from the territory of Belarus, as well as about rocket launches, trying to give Ukrainians enough time to respond and get to safety.
And there are at least two Belarusian military regiments that have crossed the border and are fighting on the Ukrainian side. But Western and Ukrainian attitudes toward Belarus are increasingly negative. And experts say things aren't likely to change there if Russian President Vladimir Putin remains in power.
The Russians, you know, have put a great deal into helping Lukashenko survive. They gave him a lot of financial aid. They sent journalists, you know, to control the Belarusian airwaves. The militaries have become very close together. The Russian intelligence services, I'm sure, have penetrated Belarus completely. They have Lukashenko pretty much where they want him.
For now, Belarus continues to hold military drills on the Ukrainian border and recently announced that Belarusian planes are now capable of carrying Russian nuclear weapons. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
Russia this week shut off a major gas supply pipeline to Germany as Europe and the U.S. accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of weaponizing energy. As Henry Ridgewell reports, there are growing environmental concerns about an unexplained Russian gas flare close to the Arctic.
Close to the Finnish border, Russia is burning off huge amounts of gas. Although flaring is common in the industry, Russia has been destroying an estimated $10 million worth of gas every day for 2 months as Europe suffers from shortages. Experts describe it as an environmental disaster. Esa Vakilainen is a professor of energy systems at LUT University in Finland.
Due to the war in Ukraine, there is very little information about what is actually happening there. So we can only speculate that right now there is some technical difficulties.
The location is Portovaya in Russia, the site of the compressor station for the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline that runs under the Baltic Sea to Germany. Russia's state-owned Gazprom has not commented on the flare. In recent weeks, Russia cut flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of capacity. And this week, it has been shut down entirely for 3 days. Russia says the turbines need maintenance. Europe disputes this and accuses the Kremlin of using gas as a weapon. The governor of the state of Bavaria, Markus Söder, spoke to reporters Wednesday. He said, I think it's a kind of game. Our problem right now is that we are not in a position to adequately respond to this game. European gas prices have soared to around 10 times their average price over the past decade. Germany declared a gas crisis in June and warned that consumers and businesses must cut back. Consumption has fallen by around 20%. In a stark speech, French President Emmanuel Macron warned of the end of abundance. He said, our freedom, the system of freedom which we are used to living in, has a cost. Russia supplied the European Union with 40% of its gas last year. As the Kremlin turns off the taps, Europe is scrambling to find alternative sources. Imports of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, including from the United States, have helped fill gas storage sites to 80% capacity, 2 months ahead of the EU target. That has calmed markets. Tom O'Donnell is an energy analyst at the Free University in Berlin.
Storage by itself isn't enough for the winter. With all the pipelines cut off, which is what we have to expect from Russia, that all their pipelines will be cut off, all the LNG we can take, you know, that storage is going to last 2.5 months in heating season. And then, you know, Europe's stuck.
Europe is trying to wean itself off Putin's gas, but analysts say it will take at least 2 years. Again, Tom O'Donnell.
In the meantime, he has leverage and he will use it all he can before he totally loses the business. The dependence of Europe on Russian delivered gas by pipeline is much greater than the, let's say, the importance of that money for Putin, because he makes so much more money from oil.
Across Europe, new LNG terminals are under construction. Old coal and nuclear power plants are being fired up again. There is big investment in renewable power. But short term, it may not be enough, and governments are warning of a difficult winter ahead. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And finally, the death of the late Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has come at a critical moment in Russia's history. Societies divided over the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and analysts say the government of Vladimir Putin is becoming increasingly authoritarian and repressive, as explained in this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau, which is narrated by Marcus Harton.
Mikhail Gorbachev wanted to modernize the USSR, reform its structures with democracy and free markets, but his reforms were a catalyst for the forces of change and ended up bringing about the final dissolution of the communist empire in Europe. His death at the age of 91 comes in a once again authoritarian Russia, involved in a war against its neighbor Ukraine, and a Russia that in many respects rejects what Gorbachev stood for, as some observers see it.
There is a certain paradox here. Gorbachev gave freedom to us all, to those people who live currently belonging to elder generations as well as to their children. But they hate him for this freedom. This is a classical escape from freedom. This is a classic resentment. We were so great, but he made us not great. He opened a window into the world, but we do not need this world.
Gorbachev's death has been an uncomfortable topic for the Kremlin, and its statements on his passing have been low-key. Gorbachev symbolizes Russia's opening to the world, just as the Putin government is taking Russia in the opposite direction. On the street, emotions range from honor and recognition by those who thank him for his service to freedom, to those who consider him a traitor to the USSR and Russia specifically, blaming him for the explosion of organized crime, economic turmoil, and political chaos in the years that followed the 1991 dissolution of the Soviet Union.
Mikhail Gorbachev is a great man who had quite a complicated job during his time. He took responsibility so that such a country as the Soviet Union was transformed, as well as required at that moment.
He betrayed a whole nation. He has made a large country collapse.
I disagree with how he pursued his policy in our country and brought our state to its collapse.
He is a person who brought freedom to our state, the only one among all the rulers who tried to do something to replace the permanent dictatorship in this country for something better.
Gorbachev spent his final years battling an undisclosed illness as Putin's Russia went to war and descended into authoritarianism, clouding his legacy as a peacemaker and a freedom-minded reformer. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington. Ba 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 zip, D.C.